affairs to order. This is March 12th, 2007. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another wonderful week in our
wonderful building.
Wonderful building, that's right. colleagues, we have some reconsiderations that we need to do. So I'd like to open
the public hearing. Works a possible.
Yes. Yeah. I think I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 341.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 341.
And the reason that we need to we passed Senate Bill 341 to the floor, but then before it even got to the clerk's office, we found that the definitions were wrong. And so we have proposed amendments from Department of Human Services. And so once they are done, we will bring them forward. So are there any objections to Senator Gourley's motion to suspend the rules? No objections. So ordered.
Okay, Madam Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we pass Senate Bill 341.
Senator Gourley moves we reconsider the vote by which we pass Senate Bill 341. Are there any objections? So ordered. All right. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 341, and I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2160.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 2160.
Senator Gourley moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 2160. House Bill 2160. We passed House Bill 2160 to the floor, but since that meeting we found that it would actually delete House Bill 2161 that we had passed out the same day. So we have to do a little minor amendments there to make sure that 2161 is still with us. Are there any objections to suspend the rules? If not, so ordered.
Madam Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2160.
Senator Gourley moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2160. Are there any objections? If not, so ordered. And colleagues, we have the amendment in front of us. Shannon, do you want to explain the amendment?
Yeah, in your packet you'll find the proposed amendment to resolve the conflicts to House Bill 2160. In Section 3, if House Bill 2161 becomes law, Section 2 of this 2007 Act is repealed because they directly conflict with each other. So that's the amendment that you have before you.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Oh, wait, we don't have a motion.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the amendment to House Bill 2160.
Senator Gourley moves the dash ones to House Bill 2160. Is there any objections? So ordered. And then move the
whole. And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2160 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gourley moves House Bill 2160 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gourley will carry this as she was the other one. And I close the work session on House Bill 2160. Now I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 36. Shannon, would you bring us up to date on this one?
Yes. Senate Bill 36, Oh, it's related to the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and two people spoke in favor of that, Jim Dameron and Grant Higginson, although there was one minor amendment that's come back, and it you should have in your packet. It allows the public health officer to send a designee in his place to the board meetings. They were finding that the public safety or the public health officer was unable to attend, but was not allowed to send somebody in his place. So this amendment resolves that by allowing him to send someone, a designee, to those meetings.
For some reason, I do not have a copy of the amendment.
Move on top of stuff. So.
And that is the dash one
mm-hmm.
amendment to Senate Bill 36.
Okay. That's just a two-page
update. Oh, I see. Just so it's just this one. Okay. All right. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 36.
Senator Gordley moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 36. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 36 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 36 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. There's no fiscal on this, is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Please. All right. Any objections? So ordered. And I'll carry this one. You have a copy. Okay, I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 36. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 562. Shannon.
Public hearing.
Public hearing. Public hearing, I'm sorry. Public hearing on Senate Bill 562.
Too many papers. Senate Bill 562 requires the Department of Human Services to award grants for primary care home pilot projects. Grant proposals shall be awarded to the extent that they include elements that meet the needs of Medicaid populations and individuals without health insurance, that integrate health services, emphasize developing human relationships, demonstrate ability to impact cost and health outcomes, and increase the access to health care services. It establishes the Primary Care Home Pilot Project Fund and continuously appropriates money from the fund to DHS for the purposes of the grants.
All right, I'd like to call Craig Hostetler, Vanetta Abdelatis. Did I mutilate that one?
Abdelatif.
Gil Munoz and Bob Marcelli. Boy, we've got a lot of diversity among the names here today.
Chair Minus Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Hostetler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Primary Care Association, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 562 on the Primary Care Home Pilot Project. Over the past year and a half, my organization has worked with a closely linked organization, Community Health Advocates of Oregon, and to expand our constituency to work with business community, hospitals, insurance companies, legislators, patients, mainstream providers, and others to develop this proposal. We've been working on this for a year and a half, as I say, and it's been a lot of good work, and I hope that it's come to a culmination where we can get something through to test this concept. So I'm going to talk about why the primary care home is needed. And basically, the 10 to 15 minute visit just doesn't work within the context of primary care, especially if you're trying to work on decreasing overall costs of the healthcare system and improve health status. Within the context of the visit, the provider takes a very linear approach. They take a look at symptoms, come up with a diagnosis, and then go to a treatment plan. And there's not much time for questions about the treatment plan from the patient within the context of the short visit, so they really aren't bought into to implementing it once they walk out the door. Also, if you're a patient with multiple conditions, several visits are going to happen within the primary care practice because that's what it pays for. The practice or the financial incentives pay for brevity, not thoroughness. financial incentives also ignore that the patient's in control of implementing the treatment plan, whether they take pharmaceuticals or not once they leave the office, whether they lose weight, stop smoking, manage glucose levels if they're diabetic, lower blood pressure, or take steps to lower blood pressure if they have hypertension, etc., is all in control of the patient. The New England Journal of Medicine in August of 2006 stated that the majority of patients with diabetes, hypertension, and other chronic conditions do not receive adequate clinical care, partly because half of all patients leaving the primary care office did not understand what the physician said. There must be a better way and a more effective way of delivering primary care services. The patients are becoming more dissatisfied, and the providers don't like it either. Between 1997 and 2005, the number of U.S. graduates entering family practice residencies dropped by 50%. In 1998, half of internal medicine residents chose primary care. Currently, about 80% either go to subspecialty work or become hospitalists. All these issues led us to develop this proposal that continued investment in the current system of healthcare providers without fundamental change is simply not enough to reach our goal of a sustainable healthcare system. So what is a primary care home? Well, we've developed a comprehensive definition that starts with the first point of contact to accessing care, linking the patient to a personal provider, and also doing outreach to bring that patient in to initiate care in the first place. The second part of our definition is sustained patient-provider partnerships, where a culture of trust is built between the patient and or the family and the provider. The essence of this partnership is focusing on empowering the patients to manage and improve their health and supporting healthy behaviors outside of the medical visit. The third part of our definition is comprehensive and integrated care, so timely and convenient access, either directly or by referral, to medical, dental, and mental health services. Also, we think that health outcomes can improve and cost savings can occur by focusing this model on prevention, chronic care, and end-of-life care. The fourth part of our definition is health system navigation and coordination, plugging the patient into the broader healthcare system as well as social and educational services. Now, I want to be clear, each primary care home needs to meet the patient where they're at, so they may implement parts or a lot of this of our definition, but doesn't have to implement every single piece of the definition. The reason is that the medical home will vary, or the primary care home will vary based on the medical and social complexity of the patients, services already provided within the community that the primary care home can refer to, as well as the setting that's easiest for the patient to access care. So what does Senate Bill 562 intend to do? You heard a brief summary at the beginning of this, but we're looking at two-year grants for clinics serving uninsured and Medicaid patients primarily, and looking at a lot of different clinics going through, not just the community health centers that I work with, but school-based health centers, rural clinics, hospital mission clinics, and others. Now, everyone should have a primary care home, and we encourage the legislature to pilot this model beyond just Medicaid and uninsured, either in this legislative session or next, to serve those clinics that are serving private pay and Medicare patients to a larger extent. Going back to our Senate Bill 562, some or many of the features can be implemented within our definition, such as mental health integration at the medical site, immediate access to providers instead of having the patient wait for several weeks. They could have access via email or phone if that's what the patient can get to. Treating multiple conditions within one visit is a part of this piece that can be implemented. Developing a robust medical and social case management program and implementing strategies to decrease ER visits. The pilot site needs to work with the community to develop this proposal to build and expand a primary care home that meets the unique needs of the populations that it serves. And each pilot project should demonstrate both short-term and long-term impact on overall costs and health outcomes. So evaluation is a fundamental part of this pilot project, with annual reports on progress that will come from each of the sites. Also, the whole pilot process should look at concrete recommendations for restructuring financial incentives to pay for more of a robust primary care home as the patients need. Now, this primary care home concept has been around for a while, and many clinics in Oregon have implemented various components of it. However, reimbursement based on short visits with a billable provider has hurt the ability of these clinics to provide the more robust primary care home that their patients need. And the pilot project would allow these clinics to reinvigorate and expand services within a primary care home model that are currently not reimbursed by the healthcare system. So as we researched health outcomes and cost-saving results from the primary care homes already established around the country, the data was hard to come by. I have to be clear about that. But we did find the following encouraging results. A 50% drop in hospital admissions, 36% drop in emergency room visits. The rate of asthma for patient hospitalization for children less than 18 years of age dropped by more than 65%. Overall, patients were less likely to be hospitalized, less likely to delay seeking needed preventive care, and had more mortality rates and lower health care costs. Mm-hmm. We also learned that this is very hard work, and it takes time to achieve the results. So the commitment needs to be for more than 2 years. And additionally, many of the remarkable results were from systems that have the primary care providers, the specialists, and the hospitals all under one roof, i.e. it's a closed system. And there will be additional challenges implementing this in an open system, but we think there's enough potential for meaningful results that warrants the investment in a pilot project. So the primary care home pilot project provides tremendous opportunity for reforming how we deliver care to vulnerable populations, and we see passage as a critical piece of reforming the healthcare system this legislative session. Thank you.
Let's go through the first four since we have a full room and we have several bills. Because Craig's testimony was pretty thorough, if you just don't repeat what's already been said, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
And because I was listening with rapt attention, I'll be clear not to do that. For the record, my name is Vanetta Abdelatif, and I'm the Director for Integrated Clinical Services at Multnomah County in Portland, Oregon. And basically that is the chief in charge of the Community Health Center, which is embedded in the health department at the county. I'm responsible for services at 7 primary care sites, 4 dental sites, 3 WIC sites, and 12 school-based health centers. Last year we served 58,000 unduplicated clients in our system, and they came for 245,000 visits, so it's a fairly large system. The people that I see are primarily women and children, although we do have men, and we serve 100% uninsured and Oregon Health Plan. 84% of the patients that I saw in my system were at 100% of federal poverty level or less, which to translate that is approximately $11,000 a year for a family of 3. So it's not a whole lot of money. I'm here to support Senate Bill 562, and the reason that I'm here is that we are looking at how can we deliver care in a different way that is not based on just visits and churning things out and widget-based kinds of system, because we're dealing with humans. And a lot of the people that we see are people that relationships are really important for how they get health care. So it's not necessarily technicians or accounting widgets that brings better health outcomes. Senate Bill 562 will allow us to have more creative thinking, would move us in the direction of being able to put together the systems and infrastructure to evaluate the effectiveness of what we do, which means how do we measure health outcomes? How can we tell what we're doing really is making a difference versus just being able to count what is easily available for us to count? We are working with Care Oregon right now. We've received some seed money for a grant to help us start with some of this thinking. A couple of years ago, I had to close a clinic, and I also a primary care clinic, and I also had to close a dental clinic 2 years prior to that, and basically to try to meet a revenue shortfall. And we want to build on what we were doing with that closure. We reorganized how we delivered care. We started looking at how could we put together teams and people who could really take care of people. The same people all the time and not widget-based. So we're working with Care Oregon to try to build on that work. Our initiative is called Building Better Care, and what we're focusing on is infrastructure and quality improvement activities to look at what changes we make and whether or not they will stay in place. And I think that this bill will help support us doing that type of work, because we need to have some kind of transition so that we're not just building on the poor some of the financial incentives that are in place now, which are going to continue to have people focus on widgets, visits, and just counting things that don't necessarily have an impact on positive health outcomes. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bob Marsali. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Klamath Health Partnership in Klamath Falls, Oregon. We are proud to celebrate our 10th year as a member of our community's healthcare network and of Oregon's safety net. And thank you for the honor of speaking with you this morning in behalf of Senate Bill 562. Our health center is here today to testify in support of that bill. Our mission as a health center is to serve our community by offering excellent care and eliminating barriers to health by providing primary and preventive medical, dental, and behavioral health care to the needy. Last year, we saw over 10,000 patients. Our numbers continue to grow by 20% every year. 54% of our patients live at or below 100% of the federal poverty level. 35% of those children, about 3,700, are children. Our health center is pleased to support this bill, and we recognize, as does the bill, that our current health care system is fractured, expensive, and poorly designed. I am being asked every day to do more for the most difficult to serve with less. SB 562 is a brave social experiment that seizes upon a practical and proven methodology to create and sustain social value. The bill is designed to ensure accurate, complete, and timely feedback to our investors, the taxpaying Oregonian, with its requirements for a strong evaluative component. And I want to add that community health centers really are the optimal leaders for this bold change effort, since we've for decades proven faithful and adept at leveraging limited resources by drawing in partners, collaborating with others in our service areas and throughout the state, cooperating with the legislature, and measuring and reporting the outcomes of our efforts, not only locally but at the federal level as well. I want to add a special appeal from one of our patients who's given permission to have her name used in the record. Her name's Leanne Chase. She's from Bly, Oregon, and that's where one of our health centers is located, one of three. She writes, I am 58 years old. I'm an unpaid caregiver for my husband and other loved ones. I paid taxes for 40 years, and I'm a registered Oregon voter. Although disabled, I do not qualify for assistance. I have been turned down by several insurance companies. The only alternative is to hold my breath, even as a one-week stay in the hospital could cost our home and everything we worked for over 40 years. I need medication, but I do without. My only help has been my health clinic, Klamath Open Door. SB 562 would allow us to provide better patient-centered care to Oregonians like Leanne, who deserve a primary care home. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of this critical step of access to health care for all Oregonians.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gil Munoz, CEO of Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center. And the thing about going forth is a lot has already been said about the model, and I won't repeat what Craig and my colleagues have so carefully laid out as far as the primary care home model. But I did want to talk a little bit about how this impacts Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center, which is a community health center which has been providing care to patients within our community for 32 years this year in the areas of Washington and Yamhill counties. We serve approximately 30,000 patients each year, and in rural areas in Washington and Yamhill counties, as well as in the city areas such as Beaverton and Hillsboro. As we have been looking at the primary care home model and have been supported also through a seed grant from Care Oregon to try and implement this as a healthcare health center administrator, I'm given pause to do this. There are all the right reasons to do it, for better patient care, higher patient satisfaction, higher employee satisfaction, yet some of the cost incentives and some of the reimbursement incentives are not there. So we're kind of stepping out on the wild side a little bit in implementing this model. Because, as has been stated, the reimbursement incentives in our current system is on the visit basis and not in proactively managing a panel of patients and looking for the ultimately the healthcare outcomes and reimbursement for such alternative care providers as the case managers are using behavioral health in ways that are different from the current reimbursement model. We are beginning to develop these integrated care teams that include physicians, medical assistants, nurses, behaviorists, and pharmacists, and working to manage panels of patients proactively. Yet we seek to do this despite not having reimbursement for such things as some of the case management that is provided through this model and care through the behavioral health care workers, or to recognize other case management kinds of services such as phone calls or emails or other alternative ways of communication with the patients. So we look to Senate Bill 562 to help give some flexibility and some breathing space to help develop this model, which we think has been very promising as for the figures that Craig has stated in reducing emergency department utilization, decreasing costs, and improving healthcare outcomes. So we encourage the committee to pass the Senate Bill 562.
Thank you very much. I know you've been working a long time on this, and we're always looking at reform, and I really think that this is one of the steps that may prove to be extremely beneficial for the whole state. Two just quick questions. What's the dollar figure? I know this is going to go down to Ways and Means. But also, are we targeting places like Klamath and Virginia Garcia?
For both of those answers, what we're looking at is a $7.5 million figure. We're working to see if some of this is matchable at the federal level, so that could bring that figure down. But the overall thing is to target 10 to 15 sites. And over a biennium, it would give each site between $200,000 to $1 million, depending on how extensive they're trying to implement the home and to how many people. We're not really targeting specific areas. We want, like I said before, a lot of different safety net clinics to go through this door. I think if you test a model, you got to make sure that it works with different models like school-based health centers, the community health centers, rural clinics, and so forth. In rural areas, they'd have to get creative. For example, they could use telemedicine or other things to link up the clinic. But we want to make sure that a lot of folks have an opportunity to implement this model.
Can I add something?
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, gentlemen.
One other piece that I want to add around the $7.5 million figure and part of what we're trying to get done. I think that one of the things about Senate Bill 562 that there's some beauty in it is that oftentimes you all are having to make decisions and trying to build systems that you are tinkering with the financial incentives. And providers are very clever around building their programs to respond to those fiscal incentives. This bill will free you up from doing that so that providers can really focus on how do you develop something that's kind of health outcomes based, so that you're not this widget system that I've talked about, trying to create your system so that you can just take advantage of the current billing system. This allows you to really build something that's going to provide better health care, which I think is real different than some of the financial systems that we have in our nation, not just here in Oregon.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to call up Jane Ellen Wiedens, Elizabeth Steiner, and Priscilla Lewis. Can't read the last name. From Providence. Lewis, Priscilla Lewis.
I'm sure it's just so lonely up there. Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for inviting me to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 562, the Primary Care Home Pilot Project legislation. My name is Elizabeth Steiner. I'm a family physician here today representing the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, a professional society of over 900 practicing physicians offering primary care services to Oregonians in every corner of the state. My testimony today will focus on three issues. First, primary care medical homes have been shown to improve costs and save improve outcomes and save costs in medical care. Second, medical homes offer the hope of a focal point for healthcare reform. Third, we need multiple models of medical homes to serve a wide range of medical needs across Oregon. Let me first begin by focusing for a moment on the definition of a medical home. Last week, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Physicians, and the American Osteopathic Society Association, which represent over 330,000 physicians across the United States, came out with a joint definition of the primary care medical home. This is included in my written testimony. But to summarize, let me just say that the medical home provides an easy-to-use point of entry into the healthcare system, coordinates ongoing comprehensive medical care that is appropriate and consistent with the patient's needs, and values and places the patient at the center of all choices concerning their care. The medical home structure supports the patient establishing and maintaining long-term relationships with the medical team while utilizing health information technology and other innovations to provide seamless and timely access to all essential care. My colleague Craig Hostetler has already done a great job of going over the three points that I was going to make, so I won't go into great detail on them. But I would say the following. First, family physicians are on the front lines of primary care across Oregon and across the United States. In many ways, we've been providing the de facto medical homes for decades. We know that when patients have access to primary care medical homes, they get better preventive care, decrease visits to emergency departments, decrease hospitalizations, and have better control of chronic diseases such as diabetes and high blood pressure. So, second, it becomes clear, as we all know, that our health system currently is irretrievably broken. We're all looking for ways to fix it. Despite spending more per capita on health care than any other country in the world, our citizens have some of the poorest health outcomes in the developed world. Our physicians are distributed disproportionately into subspecialties. However, the work of Barbara Starfield, one of the most renowned scholars in this issue of the value of primary care, shows time and again that having higher percentages of primary care physicians improves health outcomes. The patient-centered primary care medical home depends on primary care physicians, such as family physicians, to lead the teams providing health care to patients. Passing this bill into law would allow Oregon the opportunity to attest important options for fixing our broken healthcare system by emphasizing the importance of primary care and the optimization of health. My final point relates to Craig's comment about different models of medical homes. Our colleagues at the Oregon Primary Care Association have done a terrific job of demonstrating and describing a comprehensive medical home, and they serve often some of our most disenfranchised members of our society. Everyone deserves a medical home, and we must test different models of medical homes to make sure that we have models that work for all Oregonians, regardless of their source of primary care. We would encourage you to ensure that different models of medical homes, ranging from basic to comprehensive, will be considered for grants upon passage of this legislation. In summary, Senate Bill 562, the Primary Care Home Pilot Project, offers Oregon an important opportunity to test models of care that will offer Oregonians the best medical care in the most cost-effective manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Dr. Steiner.
Yes. Dr. Steiner, this is somewhat off of your presentation, but I think it's pertinent in terms of looking at medical care facilities in our state. Right now, the Department of Health has no means of being able to inspect. Very often they inspect hospitals once every 8 years. We don't know if they're, with the new surgery centers, organ donor centers, and all those things coming up, we don't have no means of doing that. Does that concern you as a physician that with us bringing more care facilities on board, that we don't have any means at this point of being able to inspect and have a standardized kind of sanitized system in our state for patient safety?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, you raise an important issue, and I want to be sure I understand your question properly. If I understand, your concern is that what we're describing as medical homes might be equivalent to healthcare facilities to things like ambulatory surgery centers. Is that your question? Am I understanding?
And my question is, we don't have any means of inspecting any of the facilities very often, and now we don't hardly have time to inspect these other centers like the surgery centers, donor centers, and all that kind of stuff. And now we're bringing more homes on. That means we're going to have even less people being able to do that for inspection.
Thank you for clarifying. If I may, let me make sure that we understand the distinction between a medical home and the kinds of facilities that you're describing. When we talk about a medical home, we're not talking about a place where people live. We're not talking about a place where that may look at least from the, we're talking about places that may look from the outside, just like the place where you go to see your family doctor today. But the difference will be that our hope is that every Oregonian will have a place to call home where they know that when they pick up the phone with a medical question or concern or a desire to lead a healthier lifestyle, they will have the opportunity to connect with a team of dedicated professionals whose primary focus is that is optimizing that person's health and optimizing the health of our communities. So, in essence, these facilities would not be the kinds of things that would be subject or appropriately subjected to state oversight in that regard, mm-hmm. because they would not be residential facilities, they would not be places where people were having significant procedures such as ambulatory surgery performed. Have I helped answer your question,
mm-hmm.
now? Thank you.
Okay.
President Courtney.
So, Doctor, you described a primary care home just now, right?
Yes, sir.
Because, you know, in all the testimony that's before me, written or verbal, I have no idea what anyone was talking about. I didn't know I was talking about a house out here with bathrooms in it, beds, people sleep in it, people live there. Is there a garage? I had absolutely no idea in all this testimony up until this very moment, thank you, Senator Mark Carter, of what was intended by a primary care home. And I'm sure I still don't know. Is it now an office? Is it a home? Does the person sleep there? Do they live there? And I have to just tell you that. I'm being very upfront with you, Mr. Chairman. I had no idea. All this written testimony, I read it and read it and read it, and I said, I don't know what they're talking about. And so to the extent that we're to understand what is meant by a primary care home, and I'm not very bright. I'll admit that to you. But if I can't get a word picture in my mind, this is the physical unit they are talking about. This is what a human being does in everyday Oregon when they go to a primary care home. Then I'm just saying, but I do thank you, because until your testimony, I was afraid to ask. I'm reading things, I'm going like this, and I says, I don't know what this is. I don't know what it is. So thank you, Senator Carter. So I don't feel quite, well, I don't mean to say this to you. At least I feel that you and I have something in common. Thank you, Chair, for telling me that.
All right. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I'm looking at the paragraph next to last in your testimony. I want to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying here. The last sentence, we would encourage you to ensure that different models of medical homes, ranging from basic to comprehensive, will be considered for grants upon passage of this legislation. And so my question to you, and also for our staff, I guess, is there specific language in the bill that covers that point, or are we needing to make sure that administrative rules cover that
question,
that point?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you. There are a couple of things that we would encourage this committee to consider changing in the current language of Senate Bill 562. In several points in Section 2, the word must is included in the definition, in particular with regard to providing transportation for patients to and from medical healthcare facilities or medical appointments, and in terms of providing assistance with dealing with all of the aspects of a person's health, including homelessness and access to nutritious food and things like that. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that all of these factors play a role in people's health. However, to imply with the use of the word must that all Oregonians have those kinds of needs and that they should be attended to by their primary care medical home probably doesn't serve the needs of a wide range of Oregonians well. So with that in mind, we would encourage restructuring slightly so that those are not considered imperatives. Those services are not considered imperative parts of a medical home. With regard to exactly how you would decide to consider multiple models of medical homes, I think we would leave that to the committee's discretion as to whether you thought it was best placed into the language of the actual legislation or whether it was considered the will of this committee and the will of the legislature upon passage of this legislation to be managed through Oregon administrative rules.
Follow-up.
Yes.
You referenced Section 2.
I believe so, ma'am. I don't have the actual text of the bill right in front of me. I apologize if I'm wrong about that.
Because I wasn't finding the language that you were referring to in that section.
I apologize. I meant to bring it up, and I left it on my desk at home. Thank you. I apologize, ma'am. It's in Section 1, subsection C. Each personal provider, line on the first page, line beginning at the end of line 28, each personal provider must facilitate a care plan that recognizes the broad social context in which the patient lives and addresses barriers to maintaining a healthy lifestyle, et cetera, such as homelessness. And then subsection D, allows patients to easily navigate and must provide patients with transportation and other services that improve access to care. Our concern is that in many clinics, doctor's offices that are currently serving as de facto medical homes, these services aren't required for our patients because fortunately these patients have the means to stay in a secure home environment, to buy nutritious food, and to provide their own transportation to and from medical appointments. Please.
Chair Montes Anderson and members of the committee, if I may, for the record, we've had a discussion about this prior to coming up here today, and we're in complete agreement. I think the translation of our original concept, you know, if a primary care home is going to be flexible, it shouldn't have, it has must for everything within it. So I think we're in agreement here.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, one other question, not for this panel, but do we know that the Department of Human Services has the capacity to award grants on the timeline that is defined in the bill? The bill says in Section 4 that grants would be awarded on a timeline 180 days after signee died.
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association. We've had initial discussions with DHS on this bill and that specific provision. They've been involved in all of our work groups throughout the entire process over the 18-month period. I'm sure that there will be some tweaking as far as the timelines, but we've not been told that they could not do so. And that's sort of a timeline that I see DHS is here and might be able to help us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joel Young from Oregon State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. I believe were this bill to pass that we would have the capacity. However, when we look at this, we probably would be estimating a staffing impact. Preliminary look at it looks something like perhaps 1.5 FTE would give us the kind of attention that we could that needs to be placed on something like this. I think the evaluation concept is really important in this, and it really needs to be looked at carefully. We really need to learn from it so we can come back to you in the future and say, this is really what worked, and this is what didn't work. So I think staffing is important. We could it could be done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I have one more? Yes, we need to hurry. We have four other bills, and so if there's, I would like to call up Pam Maria
Nason, Ralph from CARE Oregon, or Emily Katz, either one. Ralph Powers from Regents and Ellen Penny from the Oregon Health Action Campaign. Go ahead.
Thank you,
Dr. Steiner.
Madam Chair, one point that I did not include in my written testimony, but I just want to follow up on what this gentleman said. Having really good measurable outcomes is critical to the success of this project and to make sure that funds invested by Oregon taxpayers are well used. We need good health outcome measures and we need good fiscal outcome measures as part of this project. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm feeling a little frustrated. Yes. This is very serious legislation. And may I make a suggestion that
yes.
we have some extra time, because in order to digest this, I have zillions of questions in my head, and I'm not going to feel comfortable to pass on this legislation unless we have ample time to be able to flush it through.
I agree.
Thank you. I want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to testify that's here on the next bills. I'm most concerned for those on the next bills also. So I want to get everyone up to testify, please. Please, go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee. My name is Pam Maria. I'm the Public Policy and Community Affairs Director at CARE Oregon. And thanks for the opportunity. We're here to testify in favor of this bill. In order to be brief and not be at all redundant, I'm going to skip around in my written testimony, and that'll be there if you choose to read it. Basically, we are a strong proponent, and I'm glad that Senator Courtney asked the question about what does medical home mean, or primary care home. At CARE Oregon, you heard discussion this morning about the way we've been working with our providers to provide what we call project funding for changing the primary care home delivery model. Now, we've been working on a variety of projects over the last several years, and we do donate or we do dedicate staff to that project as well as dollars. We work with our safety net clinics as well as our other providers out in the community and our hospital partners around a variety of these projects. Most importantly, this year we are working on a number of projects specifically targeted at this change. And this change for us means a different way of delivering primary care services. You've heard the relationship-based. This can be in the existing clinic. It's just a different way of thinking through how those services are delivered. A good example of that would be the way we look at it, integrating a behavioralist into the model of medical care delivery that we currently have, using everyone, as we say it, at the top of their license to provide care that's really focused on the relationship with the patient. The place where that's delivered isn't as important to us. And as I said, we have several of these projects that we have initiated this year with our partners, and they're ongoing. Why are we doing this? We're a payer. We are the largest single payer for managed Medicaid in the state, and we believe that there's the opportunity to pay differently for different services that would better meet the needs of our members. If we continue to do what we've done, we're going to continue to get what we've gotten. And we really believe that there's a better way to do this, and we have seen that happen. The IHI has taught us that in order to change a system, you need to take it in small bites. You need to plan, do, study, act. And so we support demonstration projects, both ourselves and through this bill, in order to see what works before we take anything system-wide. That means we have to make an investment in that change and in exploring opportunities for change, and that requires resources. We are, one caveat, we do not want to take dollars out of the existing programs in order to fund this. We look at this as sort of research and development that needs to be going on, and that we are participating in helping fund it and believe that the state has a role in that as well. Let's see. I think that's what I want to say. In the interest of brevity, I'll be quiet for a few minutes.
Thank you.
One question.
Yes, Senator.
Would you explain to this committee about behavioralists? Because I was absolutely shocked when I found out my primary doctor would not follow me everywhere I go in my care. And so I'm wondering if that might be. And I'm glad you answered the question about research dollars, because as a ways and means person, this bill will probably come to me, and that's going to be my next question to you. So we'll just wait until you come down to ways and means for that.
All right. Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, should I go ahead and address your question now about behavioralists?
Yes.
All right. I can address it from our perspective, what we have learned and what we have seen. And to quote a wise physician, much of what the patient has control over happens once that patient leaves the office. And if we don't deal with the behaviors that create all of us choosing to follow the best medical advice and what we know would help our behavioral status or not, not being very articulate. I'll give you an example. If patients choose to smoke, that's a behavior that has a lot of components in it. But if we aren't dealing with the underlying issues that lead to that or any of our other unhealthy behaviors, then we're really truly not getting to the bottom of change for that individual. Simply providing medications and a brief office encounter doesn't work. And all you need to do is look at the trends in our society for obesity, smoking, alcoholism, pick. And we believe there's a better way to do that. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Ralph Prowse, and I am the Chief Medical Officer for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And I wanted to come here and talk with you and the committee today about this bill because I think that we are very concerned about all of the discussion about the needs of the entire population of Oregon to obtain better access to primary care, basic medical care. And this conversation is in the context of all of the health reform actions that we're all very interested in seeing get through the legislature this year. But it's not simply enough to talk about health care reform on the side of a better way to finance these services, primary care, basic medical care, if we aren't also talking about how we're going to spend that money exactly. I think we agree that we need to have better access for these basic medical services. But as you all know, right now the way that money gets spent is not very effective and it's not very efficient. You're familiar with the medical error rates and how many fatalities we see nationally with that. You're familiar with the rising cost of care and the fact that Americans right now are receiving recommended basic health care services along medically accepted guidelines only about half the time. It's worse than the Blazer free throw record. We've got to do better than that. We've got to do better than that. So I'm really interested that we not only tackle the reform side from the financing of it, but we've got to begin some experimentation and some development, some redesign of how that money gets spent better for people. And I think that's what this medical home concept really is attempting to do. Like Pam and her organization, Regents has also invested in the last couple of years in experiments to try to inform us a little bit better, try to catalyze some change on the delivery redesign side. Because, in essence, we're really talking here about whether we just put more money into a system, the system that is a fee-for-service system and pays for the 5 to 10 minute visit to a physician and then maybe a number of procedures, but does not pay to integrate that care, does not pay for the kinds of services that will speak to people who are less able to understand what a physician tells them from the physician compared to receiving that same information perhaps from a nurse or a nurse practitioner, someone who isn't just limited to that 5, 10, 15 minute visit, that piecemeal visit, to deliver care in a better way. And pay to integrate the care. When a patient requires that specialty care and needs to leave the family practice office or the internal medicine office and go see a behavioralist or go see a specialist, who's going to coordinate that and bring it back together and make sure that the right decisions get made with the information and feedback from the specialist? Our system today doesn't pay for any of that, so it doesn't get done. There are no good tracking systems. There aren't incentives to track that kind of behavior and coordinate that care in our current fee-for-service environment. So, like Care Oregon, Regents has been experimenting to try to inform us of better systems, get to the point of deciding on maybe some better ways to pay for it as well, that will align the incentives for the delivery side with the priorities of our public health needs. So we've entered into pilots with about 11 different medical groups over the last year. We've attempted to provide catalyst funding, incentive funding for an organization, our community, that is LeGrand, to try to connect the dots, if you will, electronically between the practices, the hospital, all of the providers in that area, so that when a patient goes into one of those offices, that the physician, the nurses, the others at that office can pull the information together from all those variant sources to try to make an informed decision and help coordinate that care. But if we don't start down this path of redesign, and it's going to take some experimentation to figure out the right model, if we don't start down this path now, when the day comes that we do have better funding, my fear is that we're going to continue to fund a system that is deeply flawed, not integrated, fragmented, and we're going to continue to get what we pay for. So that's why I was here today. I think that this bill is meritorious in terms of asking us to experiment boldly in healthcare redesign and not simply leave this up to some evolving system, but to put some intelligent redesign into the process as we go forward. Thank you very much mm-hmm. for letting me speak to you for a few moments about that.
Thank you. I need to understand from Mr. Hotstetler, because you're the one that has this wonderful agenda of people here, and we had scheduled 45 minutes for it, and I know that we have Martin Taylor, Andy Miller, Mary Beth Healy, Chris Damons, Bob Dupree, Laura Branner, Ellen Penny, Priscilla Lewis, and Jane Ellen Whedons, and there's no way that we can get through all of them because this program is extremely important, and like Senator Carter was saying, we really need time to ask questions and make sure we understand. Are there maybe some of these people that should be testifying that would give a different perspective and allow us to quiz you a little bit more thoroughly?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I think it's a good question. Obviously, what we're doing is showing that all parts of the system we've been working with by getting various stakeholders up from the insurance company and others. I hate to invite people down here and not have them testify, but what I'd like to do is if they could come up and just say just a couple quick words instead of, because I think we've covered a lot of points, to say where they're from, one kind of sentence on why it's important to them, and we go on. Would that be?
Oh, yes. I want, as long as people understand, because I'm willing to go past the time, although I know we're supposed to be in caucus at 10:15 and floor session at 10:30, but I think Senator Gorley and I are willing to stay as long as possible, and I'm not sure if the others would be able to or not, but I know President Courtney couldn't.
Okay.
So, Martin Taylor, Andy Miller, Mary Beth Healy.
In the interest of time, I won't wait for everybody else. Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Martin Taylor. I represent the Oregon Nurses Association. I should state that these are not settings where we typically have membership. We don't have collective bargaining agreements and the kinds of safety net clinics we're talking about. Occasionally, we have nurse practitioners or other nurses who choose to associate with ONA as a professional, but not through collective bargaining. I would say that we're strong supporters of the bill. I'd love to be part of a larger conversation if you have one, but I don't have so much unique insight to contribute that I should take any more of your time. ONA supports this bill.
He threw a bomb and left.
All right.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, for the record, I'm Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst for the Oregon Business Association. You can read my comments. Basically, our organization wants to look at fundamentally changing how healthcare is delivered. And by this, we mean addressing access, quality, and cost. OBA believes it's in the business community's best interest to have a strong public sector health program. We are seeking an affordable system of public health that emphasizes healthy lifestyles, illness prevention, and access to health care when necessary, with public expenditures for medical cost effectively allocated. Preventative services are the key to controlling much more costly health care services when minor conditions are left untreated. The primary care home model fits this description. Primary care home model improves people's health and reduces health system waste and fragmentation, and that's what we call a win-win. Thank you.
Madam Chair, didn't you call Ms. Penny and some other
people? Yes, I did.
I have to leave at 10 o'clock, and I'd like to hear the bill.
Okay, Laura Brenner, Bob Dupree, Chris Damas.
I'd like to hear the bill, too.
Yeah.
For the record, my name is Ellen Penny. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We are strongly supportive of this bill. It is one of the few bills this session that focus on actually improving the delivery system, which we think is an essential component of successfully getting to health care for all. Expansion of not purely investment in a delivery system which is held accountable for assuring that the most medically and economically vulnerable are able to easily and comfortably access providers who understand their needs is vital both for cost containment and for improved outcomes. I would just point out, you have my testimony in front of you. I think there are some key features, and the one that I would just like to focus on is that this bill is about creating models tailored to individual and community needs. Those words imply that the communities that would be getting these grants should have some kind of a role in helping define who's at the table and what those projects would look like. We would like to see community advisory committees play into the larger advisory committee that is recommended in Section 2. In addition, it says the grant proposal contains one or more of the following features on page 2, line 27. It seems that all of those features would be essential for a successful proposal. That's the end of my testimony. We encourage and urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is this on? Here. My name is Chris DeMars, and I'm a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about Senate Bill 562 and the support of this bill's goals by both the Northwest Health Foundation and the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative. I'll whittle down my statements to the kind of essence what I wanted to talk about today. The Northwest Health Foundation values the opportunity to serve as a convener, and a recent outgrowth of this convening role, undertaken in partnership with the Oregon Health Policy Commission, is the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative, which has identified the primary care home pilot project legislation as a building block to comprehensive health reform in Oregon. The collaborative recently outlined a set of broad principles and the necessary first steps for health reform in the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative Consensus Statement, which you have in front of you. The Northwest Health Foundation also recently sent a copy of this statement, both electronically and through the mail, to all legislators. And the bottom line of the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative Consensus Statement is this: comprehensive health reform is necessary and possible. True reform means not merely expanding access to the growing number of uninsured, but addressing the deep systemic problems within our current system. We hold a common vision for comprehensive health care reform that provides affordable, accessible, equitable, and efficient health care for all Oregonians. To address the fundamental problems in the health care system, this statement also outlines four essential building blocks for this legislative session that will support comprehensive health reform. One of these building blocks addresses the goal of Senate Bill 562. It reads, create pilot programs that support community efforts to provide Oregonians with a primary care home where they can develop a long-term relationship with a provider team and count on receiving timely, affordable, comprehensive, and high-quality care. The Oregon Health Reform Collaborative Consensus Statement has been signed by the following organizations: Archimedes Movement, Code Blue Now, Healthcare for All Oregon, Medicaid Advisory Committee, Metropolitan Alliance for the Common Good, the Northwest Health Foundation, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Oregon Business Council Healthcare Task Force, Oregon Health Action Campaign, Oregon Health Policy Commission, Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Primary Care Association, Oregonians for Health Security, Pacific Source Health Plans, and the Working Families Party.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
if I could stop you right there.
I've read
the document several times, and what's missing from the document and what's missing for me is any indication that the foundation has a connection to organizations like the African American Health Coalition, Native American Rehabilitation Association, organizations that serve the Latino community, Asian community. If those relationships exist, it's not explicit in any of the documents, in any of the communication that you're sending into my office and sending into this building. And that's a serious omission that needs to be addressed. A part of our concern is about eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. And that's a subject, that's an issue that needs to be owned by all of healthcare. So again, if your organization is doing work in that regard, let us know about it.
Okay, Senator Montes Anderson, Senator Gordley, I appreciate the question. It's a very good question. When the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative was developed about a year ago, the groups that were included were those that were primarily focused on reforming the healthcare system as one of their top priorities.
All of the organizations that I've named, mm-hmm. I don't want to get into a debate because we have a lot of time here. Mm-hmm. You can respond to me offline.
Okay.
But all of the organizations I've named are doing work around healthcare reform. And again, I'm saying that your organization is coming to us with an umbrella approach, and underneath that umbrella, you've missed some folks. You've missed some organizations that are key in this discussion.
And Chair Monis Anderson, Senator, you can talk about that offline if you want, but if I could just quickly address it. At this point, the Health Reform Collaborative is going to be engaging upon a very broad engagement campaign and trying to get as many organizations as possible to sign on to the consensus statement. We just recently finalized it. So
where we make a mistake in Oregon, continue to make a mistake, is not inviting these communities in to be participants at the beginning.
That's right.
Not after the fact, not as an addendum,
that's right,
but in the beginning, in the discussion and planning phase. And that's the point that I'm trying to get across to you.
Thank you.
That message back to your organization, please.
I appreciate the comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Bob Dupree here? Is Laura Brennan or Grant Higginson here that need to testify? This is the list. Okay. And you. Okay. And do you have anything further than what you said?
Very brief.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm Joel Young from Health Systems Planning, Oregon Public Health Division, DHS. Senate Bill 562 is not in the governor's budget, so for that reason, we can't support it. But what we do believe is that it contains a lot of really powerful ideas, and those ideas, if put into play, do have a chance of making a contribution to how well the health delivery system works. And all I would say is that it would appear to us that it focuses on using and further developing the medical home idea to tie together the loose threads and the fragments of our delivery system. It's got a lot of promise, I think, around access, reducing disparities, and improving health outcomes, again, depending on how it's implemented. It seems timely, given where we're going with improving coverage for children. It won't fix everything that's wrong with the current system, but it does appear, if this process went forward as it's outlined, that it could make a substantial improvement.
Thank you. Now, I've called everyone up. Is there anyone that wasn't on the list that wants to testify on Senate Bill 562? It is my intent I would like to move this to Ways and Means. I know that Senator Carter is just waiting with bated breath to address this. And that is the correct, is that your intent? Yes. Okay. All right. All right. Then I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 562, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 562. I would like to say, when Doug Riggs and Craig Hochstetler have talked to me about this, it's such an incredibly important way to, it's a part of a health policy or health care reform. And I know there's a lot of health care reform going on in this, but this is a very doable one where we get down at the community level, as Senator Morissette always says, golly, I want the grassroots to start it. And this has definitely been a grassroots effort, so I'm really quite excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Any other comments?
Madam Chair, yeah. This is quite an innovative idea. There's no doubt about it, and I think cutting edge things of this nature that's going to save us future costs is really, really an important feat.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Senator Crute. No. Yeah.
I'm going to make the motion. But
thank you. Just comment, and obviously I'm a sponsor of the bill, so one would assume I support it. But I think Senator Gordley made some very valuable points as to making sure that the community piece of this may need to have more focus on that than what's in the bill itself. And so Senator Gordley put on the record, I'm also putting on the record that clearly as we're looking for these pilots, the community involvement and the community integration needs to rise to a higher level when we're looking at those projects that that are funded in this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate that comment very much, Senator Cruz. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 562 to the Ways and Means. Do we need to specify which committee? Human Services?
No, probably just Ways and Means.
The Ways and Means.
With a due pass?
With a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 562 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Discussion. Madam Chair, I think that when a bill of this nature comes to Ways and Means, it's going to only thing that's going to be discussed are fees, cost. But in terms of general public, and especially those groups that have health disparities issues, African American Coalition and other groups, they've not had a chance to respond to this bill. And since the gracious president is sitting here with us, I would like to have additional hearing with those groups being at the table to discuss these issues. And I'm just one person, I admit.
Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
No.
Senator Courtney?
Wait a minute. Stop.
Only, Mr. President, because we haven't had these other people at the table.
Let me suggest, Madam Chair.
Yes.
The recommendation do pass. I think the bill should simply move to Ways and Means without recommendation. That's what I suggest at this stage. You've got to deal with what we're dealing with here to be sure that you leave it open for whatever needs to be done in Ways and Means and you do not position, et cetera, et cetera. That's all I'm going to suggest you do if you want to move it to Ways and Means, Chair. That's all I'm going to suggest.
Then I could pass that. It's not in the governor's budget. It's right. Not in the co-chair's budget.
Right.
And I don't want to raise false hope.
I totally agree, and that's the signal. That, and I'm not trying to be difficult, Madam Chair, embarrass anybody here. I'm just suggesting things do move to other committees without recommendation. The record moves with it. It's been established here. And I would just like to suggest that be considered. That's all I'm suggesting.
Are you willing to rescind?
Yes, I'm willing to change the motion. We just need to get it back in front of us. So I rescind the earlier pass. Motion, which
Senator Gordley rescinds her due pass recommendation, but does the motion remain intact to go to Ways and Means?
Move to Ways and Means without recommendation.
All right, Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 3562 to Ways and Means without recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Chairman Anderson?
Aye. Motion passes. Okay.
Now she has to give a motion.
All right.
Senator Gordley now needs to do a motion to move it to Ways and Means.
No, just did.
She does. Did.
Oh, she rescinded
the due pass recommendation.
We didn't just vote on that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Very good.
All right. I need to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 341. There are people here to discuss very briefly the amendments so that they will not have to come back next time. So would...
You're not moving it. You're just...
No, we're not moving it.
Okay.
I don't have the list for who's coming, so...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Michael Seeley. I'm the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Transport Bank. I'm joined by my colleague Barbara Crow, Executive Director of the Oregon Lions Eye Bank. We're here in support of the bill, Senate Bill 341, as proposed to be amended. This bill will ensure appropriate oversight mechanisms in place with regard to organ, eye, and tissue transplantation in the state of Oregon. Its introduction is right and timely, furthering ongoing efforts to enhance public safety and trust. Senate, this bill, as proposed in its amendments, would require that organ, eye, and tissue organizations serving Oregon are federally certified or designated. In addition, it requires that any healthcare facility that performs an organ transplant must be a member of the National Organ Procurement and Transplant Network and obtain organs from the organ procurement organization designated by the Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Any healthcare facility performing an eye or tissue transplant must acquire that tissue or eye from a Food and Drug Administration registered and regulated eye and tissue bank. We support the provisions that are proposed requiring that we register our organizations with the state of Oregon. We find the reporting requirements to be reasonable and congruent with the ongoing national efforts to heighten transparency in this important and essential life-saving endeavor in healthcare. Thank you for the opportunity to present our testimony.
Thank you. Senator, I am Barbara Crow, Executive Director of the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon, and I want to concur with my colleague, Michael Seeley, in support of this bill as amended. This is a perfect time to, I think, given things that happen throughout the country, to increase the transparency of our organizations. Anything that we can do to enhance public safety is very important to us, and we want that known and let it known that we support this amended bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joel Young from the Department of Human Services, State Public Health Division, and here on behalf of Dr. Grant Higginson. And we've been in discussion with OHSU and these folks, and I think we're all largely in agreement that this is a good piece of legislation, a necessary one. I know that Grant worked on some amendments to help clarify definitions, and I believe those have been discussed with folks. I have copies of those here. I'm a little unclear, since I'm pinch-hitting here, whether you already have those. I believe they're moving on to legislative council for incorporation into a document that you can review, but I'd be happy to give you copies of what Grant put together if that's useful right now.
At this point, we will wait for the amendments to come back, and I just wanted to get so that you wouldn't have to come back. The intent of this legislation is just to have our organ bank and tissue banks register, and that's it. Just register with the Department of Human Services so that they are aware of what are the organ banks, where they are in the state, and that was the sole purpose with this legislation. So we just need to get that on the record, and that is all right with you also.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 341. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 360. Senator Morissette, thank you for patiently waiting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. It was a real pleasure to sit and listen to the discussion on Senate Bill 562. It is an outstanding, excellent beginning for the health care reform, and it's a great bill. So, do pass. My recommendation, do pass. Thank you very much for hearing this series of bills. We're not going to get through all of them today. Senate Bill 360 is a health care ombudsman. bill to assist the seniors and people with disabilities in the process and so on and so forth. There are, this is on behalf of Kay Metzger from Lane County, and Kim Baxter. So I'll turn it over to them. They have excellent testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kay Metzger. I'm the Director of Senior and Disabled Services. We're a division of Lane Council of Governments and an area agency on aging and disability. We serve the people in Lane County, and we have a contract with the Department of Human Services to do Medicaid and food stamp eligibility for seniors and people with disabilities. In Lane County, there's over 9,000 seniors and people with disabilities that participate in the Oregon Health Plan and receive the benefits. Statewide, there's over 90,000 seniors and people with disabilities. And so there's a lot of folks out there that are receiving those benefits. Our staff have firsthand experience working with our clients trying to access the benefits through the Oregon Health Plan. The system's very complex. And our clients are easily confused by the notices and the procedures that they must adhere to access the benefits that they're eligible for. Many are frail, and they have difficulty understanding what they must do. Some have family members or friends that can help them out and help them work through it. Some of our staff at times are able to help them work through the processes, but with our staff carrying over 450 cases each, many of them, they're stretched pretty thin and don't really have to, aren't always able to do that. As a result, then, of no one available to speak for some of our clients, they go without at times. They go without the benefits that they need, or the medical supplies. They don't understand what they need to do, so they give up. And while this might save some money in the short run, in the long run, it really can be more costly if a person with disability goes without a piece of equipment and then deteriorates or experiences some injury and then must be hospitalized or have some nursing home care. So there, in the longer term, that can be more expensive. The structure currently in place within the Department of Medical Assistance Programs that addresses client access problems needs improvement. From my own experience, it seems to do a better job of representing the needs of the system rather than the needs of the people. Recently, I spoke to someone from the governor's advocacy office, and when I asked her, what do you do when you get a question about or a problem related to the Oregon Health Plan, they told me that, well, they refer it over to the Department of Medical Assistance Programs, the Client Advisory Services Unit. After that, one of our advisory council members spoke to a staff member from that very unit, and what he was told was that they're very clear in their focus that their responsibility is to instruct clients regarding the rules and regulations and the procedures rather than assisting the clients with problems in the eligibility process. So we see the need for an independent health care ombudsman as critical, someone to speak for the clients outside of the structure of the Department of Human Services. And I thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Bonus Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Also in favor of Senate Bill 360, my name is Tim Baxter. I work for Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. The primary feature of this bill would take a provision that already exists in the law for Oregon Health Plan Ombuds Services to the elderly and disabled out from under the Department of Human Services and put it directly under the governor. I would refer you to the written materials that I submitted with my written testimony, in particular a report from the Department of Medical Assistance Programs in 2003, an annual report where the agency stated that in 2002 their client assistance unit, quote, began focusing less on traditional advocacy for OHP clients and more on a coaching model of assistance, unquote. That is, the agency was going to turn away to help themselves those people who are among most vulnerable in our state. Now, in 2005, there was a similar bill before the legislature. Then DMAP, Department of Medical Assistance Programs Administrator Barney Spate, testified before Senator Morissette's committee in opposition to that bill. He made a lot of promises to improve things within his agency in terms of ombuds and advocacy services. Within a few months, Mr. Spate was gone to Washington State. Last month, we met with Dr. Alan Duma, who was at that time the current Division of Medical Assistance Programs Administrator. He acknowledged to us that he had not even been aware that there was a client assistance unit within his agency. Now, we might have been able to work with Dr. Duma, but Friday, we found out that Dr. Duma has suddenly resigned his position, effective today. What I think this illustrates is that there is a critical need for an independent, freestanding Oregon Health Plan Ombuds function that is not going to be subject to the vagaries of a revolving door of administrators within DHS. Now, I have talked to Rhonda Busick of LIPA, Lane Individual Practice Association, Managed Health Care Plan in Lane County. She's a person I respect. LIPA is an organization that I think has been doing excellent work. And I know that health plans are concerned that they will be getting multiple inquiries from different sources on the same situation. This bill would avoid that. This bill provides for referral of cases requiring investigation over to the healthcare ombudsman. And I would also note that it's not going to put any more added burden on health plans than is already now provided for in the law. It's just that the law has not been exercised up until now. And I would submit that the health plan that is doing a good job should not fear but should welcome the intermediating services of a health plan ombudsman. And the ombudsman will save money in the long run. As the old TV commercial goes, you can pay now or you can pay later. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Question? L.M. Reese, Mary Johnson.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mary Johnson. I'm a member of the Advisory Board, Senior and Disabled Services, Lane County of Governments. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come and speak in favor of Senate Bill 360. I want to tell you about my personal experience. In 2005, my partner of many years, John Robotham, was in the final stages of Parkinson's disease. He had survived a terrible pneumonia. He was in a skilled nursing facility. His doctors were saying nursing home. John himself wished to go back to his studio apartment in a residential home for seniors. To do that, we needed a lot of caregivers, much more than we could afford. We were able to establish an income cap trust for John, and he became a Medicaid client for the last 8 years of his 8 months of his life. I was his trustee, and I wrote his checks as directed under a very tight budget. The majority of the money went to the state to pay John's share of the cost of the caregivers. Anyway, I was told that John's essential medical expenses would be covered by the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, OMAP. But several of my requests that I thought were pretty reasonable were turned down. One was a prescription for a food supplement, sure. John at this time weighed about 80 pounds. He was basically emaciated. His neurologist wanted him to drink a lot of Ensure. I was just arbitrarily turned away. I never learned anything about why this request was turned down. The clerk at the pharmacy didn't know anything about it. They just simply said no, and that was that. I learned later from another source, a social worker, that probably the criterion was that if you're receiving something like Ensure through a feeding tube, you're eligible, and if you can still swallow, you're not. But I got no explanation for that. Another was a problem that came up, again, a small one, was for Depends, which are incontinence supplies. The only one that was available through the Office of Medical Assistance Program was a kind of diaper for adults, which had a tape on the side. Well, his hands were so crippled that he couldn't possibly use that, whereas he could somehow manage to pull up his own pants. Again, I never got an explanation, but I think probably the Depends cost more. Fortunately, I was still working at this time. I was able to meet these expenses, so probably I contributed about $150 a month, something like that. This is a small matter, but I think that it's indicative of a larger problem. This agency is really, this is the Office of Medical Assistance Programs or the department. They're really an insurance plan for other agencies, but they don't have any direct contact with the clients that they serve, and I think I found their behavior arbitrary and capricious. I didn't argue with it at the time because I was utterly stressed out by the situation, and I think most people in that position feel a lot of stress. I think this population really is kind of helpless. So what you have is this all-powerful agency and the little people. I mean, I felt like Oliver Twist in the workhouse daring to ask for more. It was really pretty insulting. The appeal process is there. If you look on the web page, you find CASU, but it's hard to use, and I think it's mostly window dressing. I feel that there's no check and balance in this system, and that what we need is some kind of independent something outside the agency which can address problems. I mean, as I say, these are small problems, and I was able to deal with it, you know, in a way. But it could be a large problem. I think people should be allowed to ask questions. I think that they should receive courteous explanations. I mean, there have to be rules, but I think that you are entitled to an explanation for the rules, and so I support this. To finish my story, I tell you that John Robotham died in September of 2005. He died in his own home, surrounded by the books and music and pictures that he loved, with those of us who cared for him around him. He basically had a death with dignity. And I think the whole process cost a great deal less than if he had gone into a nursing home. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to thank the state of Oregon for making that possible. Thank you very much. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
And when you mentioned the Depends, that isn't just... my father has Parkinson's, so I've gone through the same thing.
Yes.
And the ones with tapes are terrible.
They just don't
so
work.
I just go out and buy the Depends because... And the Depends, they have tapes, too, so they're...
Yeah.
But it's little things like that that make such a...
Pants,
but they are much more expensive.
I'm sure.
And there isn't the money, unfortunately, and so there has to be choices that we have to make. Yes.
I understand that, but I think that they could have given me a one-paragraph explanation. This is the rule that covers a food supplement like Ensure. This is the rule that... I didn't get any explanation. I never learned anything about it except a denial from the pharmacy clerk. And I think that's high-handed myself. As I say, I didn't argue at the time because I had far more important things to do. But after John died and I started thinking about this and I looked at the web page, I felt this is kind of Byzantine. I mean, I'm a librarian. I'm used to web pages. But it would be very hard to approach that department, perhaps on bended knee, and ask for an explanation. And so I support the idea of an ombudsman. I'm certainly not a contentious person. I just think that there's another side that needs to be heard, and that we would all be better off if an establishment of checks and balances existed, as it does with agencies that work directly with the public, because there is the human feedback.
Yes.
Now I will stop. Okay.
Chairman Ms. Anderson and committee. When I was born...
Please introduce yourself.
My name's L.M. Reese. I live at 1133 Olive Street, apartment 315, Eugene, Oregon. When I was born, they told my parents I would never sit up by myself. I used my manual chair to get around my apartment and in my building because I need to use my legs to keep strengthening them so I can use them. At the present time, I can only get maintenance for what they call my primary chair, which is my electric chair. But the electric chair doesn't do me any good inside. I need an advocate very bad to help me get through to the right people to get help to maintain my manual chair so I can continue using my legs and not lose the use of them. I thank you for letting me testify this morning, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
Mary Johnson, Cindy Becker, and Ellen Penny. And if you could keep your comments to about a minute or two, and we'll... What my plan is for Senate Bill 363 and 364 is to be moved to Wednesday's meeting.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. We are not in support of Senate Bill 360, primarily not because we don't think that people need advocacy, but there are systems in place. The plans, the Medicaid Managed Care plans, have language in their contracts. There's language in the DMAP rules that speak to the requirement to a grievance process and appeals process. If those processes are not working, then the respective agency and the providers need to be held accountable. But adding yet another oversight isn't necessarily going to make the systems work. It's going to be additional money for the department and for the plans. There's also language in here that speaks to potential contract changes as a result of this, again, without any necessarily any money to go with that. If there's some problems with the system, let's fix them. The department also, in addition to DMAP, has a governor's advocacy office. Those individuals report not only to the director of the agency, but also have a direct line into the governor's office. There are systems out there already. We suggest and we support using those systems. If they're not working, let's fix them. Let's not just automatically assume by adding yet another oversight, yet another system is going to solve the problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Ellen Penny, Oregon Health Action Campaign. We supported this concept last session, and we support it again. I would say briefly for the record that all managed care plans that serve Medicaid clients are not created equal. We do operate a health helpline, and we hear about access problems and other problems on a regular basis. As Ms. Becker pointed out, there are other systems and other ways of dealing with the problems that we identify, and we encourage all people to use those systems. What this bill would create is that is currently not available through CASU, the Client Advocacy Services Unit, and other vehicles, is the right of this ombudsman and the requirement for the ombudsman to investigate and resolve complaints, issue findings and recommendations, including recommendations for potential contract changes. And that this person would serve as an advocate for the client and would advertise their services. We would like to see a grievance process that is beyond just reporting numbers, but a grievance process that allows us to change barriers in the system that keep people or prevent people from getting the access they need. And we see this bill as a vehicle for doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Not a question, just a comment, and I'm reflecting on the earlier testimony from the woman who's now sitting back in the audience, and I'm sorry I can't... Mrs. Metzger.
we keep talking about systems, and again, this is just a comment. Systems are made up of people. And so, you know, I'm always, as I hear the testimony, the question in my mind is, what kind of people skills do the people have who are working in these systems? And how compassionate are the people who are working in these systems? No, those are just questions. This is not to indict anyone or to suggest that people don't have the skills and are not compassionate. But it is a piece that we always need to be talking about. And we always need to be asking ourselves those questions. The folks who are on the, who are working in these systems and who are responsible for helping those who have problems, and who are in, you know, going through really traumatic circumstances, the helpers do need to be compassionate, and they do need to have a certain quality of skill. So as I'm listening to the testimony, I'm listening it with that listening to it with that thought in my mind. And when we say we need to hold people accountable for being compassionate, hold people accountable for having the people skills. You know, we need to be clear about what we're saying when we say hold people accountable for the good of the order. Just needed to make that statement.
Thank you. Jim Edge can come up, and Senator Morissette.
Thank you very much. This kind of dredges up all of what happened last year when Barney Spate was here. Lynn Reed was the recipient of complaints that thick. There were hundreds of complaints about LIPA not providing adequate services. Those complaints were forwarded to the department. Lynn Reed tried to deal with them. Barney Spate tried to deal with them. Gary Weeks, we had a hearing. The room was packed, and it ranged all the way from how much they were charging for durable goods, excessive amounts for durable goods. There were a number of complaints that thanks to Tim Baxter, who was here to testify, and thanks to Terry Copeland, all of that was worked out. But it was a flaw in the system that allowed it to happen. And yes, it takes people who are sensitive, people who are willing to work together to solve the problems. That's the best of all worlds. What if it isn't? What if we don't have those people? That's why we need this independent ombudsman person. I think you were here during a lot of that testimony. So I'm just saying that there are a lot of things that have been fixed, but it's a safeguard that we're talking about. So thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge, for the record. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. My first day in that role, so it doesn't flow easily off the tongue yet. But I can make my testimony very quick. Just want to say that the department is fully supportive of client rights and fully supportive of clients getting appropriate services and fully supportive of resolution of client issues. And in that sense, we understand the purpose behind this bill and we fully support the purpose of the bill. Just a couple of things I would point out. One is, yes, there is some duplication of services between what this bill proposes and what exists in the managed care plans in the Department of Human Services and the Governor's Advocacy Office. And to that extent, there's a little additional cost there, but I agree there is not an ombudsman function right now that oversees the Oregon Health Plan. And to the extent that an ombudsman would improve services to clients, we're all for that. We want to see the right services provided. We want to see the issues resolved. The other issue I would just point out is that we weren't certain from the original bill where this office would be located. I understand that there's going to be a Dash 1 amendment that makes it clear it's not in DHS, it's somewhere else. So the cost of this has not yet been fully calculated, and it's not in the governor's recommended budget. So officially the department is neutral on this bill, but we do understand the concern, and we fully support the client rights issue. Thanks.
Thank you. Being a public health nurse, I was always the advocate for my patients. Knowing case managers, they are always the advocate. And I do realize the complexities and problems that we face in trying to meet all of the needs, especially with those who have disabilities that, or illnesses that require a lot of intensive time and cost a lot of money. It's an extremely complex issue, and there's no easy answer. I think the intent of this bill is right on, and we will continue deliberating on where we go with this bill. Anyway, thank you for coming.
Question.
Yes.
Chair, before you go to the gavel. Mr. Edge, in the context of this bill and the populations that are of concern in the bill, question for you. Has there been an audit, a recent audit of client complaints and how those complaints have been resolved?
Chair Moss Anderson and Senator Gordley, yes, we do track complaints. We do have a process, a quality improvement, quality assurance process that tracks complaints specifically from the managed care plans. We also track the calls that come in to our 800 numbers, and that information is available. We can make it available to you if you'd like.
I would request that for the committee, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Any recent audits, recent in my mind would be looking at the last 5 years, and findings, recommendations coming out of those reports, and how the, if there were recommendations, how those recommendations are being implemented.
Certainly. Not audits, I don't think, but there are reports that are done on that information.
And I'm using the word audit to suggest that, to ask the question, has there ever been an outside or external look at how complaints are dealt with?
We'll look through our files and make available to you what we have. I'm not sure that we ever have had an outside entity look at that, but I'll go back to the office and see what we have, and we'll make it available to you.
A thorough response would be very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 360, and I would like to move us or have moved to Wednesday, March 15th, Senate Bill 363 and Senate Bill 364. Is there anything else I need to do to make this legal?
No.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to the next two bills, but we are required to be on the floor. The President, Senator Courtney, informed us, so I was not able to go longer as I had originally said. With that, the meeting's adjourned.